Steve, welcome back to the podcast, mate. It's great to see you.
Hey, Chris, it's great to be back. Thank you for having me.
So I really enjoyed Government Cheese. And the first question I have to ask you is, you finished Government Cheese, it's out now. What are you working on now? What's the new book? What's the new project?
You remember this book from like about 2 years ago, A Man at Arms, which is kind of, you know, set in the ancient world. And so I'm doing a follow-up to that, kind of the further adventures of the same character, Telamon of Arcadia, the one-man killing machine of the ancient world.
I was going to say Telamon, such a great name. How, when you write these books, are you firing from the hip, albeit from the hip based in a lot of training and experience, or are you an outliner? How are you going about this?
Ah, that's a great question. I mean, I try to do both things. I got to ask you the same question, Gaz. Because there's so many, as you know, so many happy accidents happen along the way, you know. You get 80 pages, 90 pages, 100 pages in, and a minor character starts to take on a life of its own and things change. But I'm definitely a believer in, from my screenwriting days, of knowing the ending before I begin,
right,
knowing the final scene, knowing exactly how it ends, and then kind of working backwards to that, building up to that, doing all the setup that's necessary to make that happen. So I, in other words, I do sort of outline it, but I leave room for happy accidents along the way, which always come. What about, let me ask you, how do you do it?
I'm after thinking that I was just had, I used to think like, oh, I could just, you know, storytelling, it's just storytelling. You shouldn't need to outline it and stuff. And then that's obviously a really poor way of looking at it. And now, I outline quite heavily now because it really helps me hit the beats and get the beats in the right places. So just to explain to people what I mean by beats is like, you know, there's always that movement moment in a film where the, you know, it's the all is lost moment where, you know, everyone's abandoned the main character or he's abandoned them. And it looks like, oh, how the hell is he going to get himself or she's going to get herself out of this predicament? You know, so I outline now to get those beats in the right places. And I find if you do that, you then have, you can change characters and how characters interact and everything. And you can change a character's voice and you can change scenes. But as long as those beats are there, because trying to reorganize beats, if you fuck that bit up, is a lot of work, especially on a book. I mean, you know the score.
I would say the same thing now that I think about it. You know, the various beats of like the inciting incident, the act one curtain, the midpoint of act two, the all is lost moment, you know, and then the climax. I want to know those ahead of time, just like you. You can move everything else around, but you can't move those around.
No. And I found that's really helpful. And I think it's time invested that makes the pro. Because, I mean, a lot of people write, and anyone listening to this wanting to do a book, and I know there's quite a few, you know, the temptation is, oh, you know, I've got 2 hours a night that I can work on this, you know, and it's like, I just want to get into it because I want to, you know, it's going to take so long if I'm only doing 2 hours a few nights a week. So I think it's very tempting for people to skip over the outline.
Yeah.
But it really will. I mean, my grandma used to say a stitch in time saves nine.
Uh-huh.
And I think like that is, that's really true when it comes for, I mean, it's like anything, right? If you were starting a business, you know, if you just opened the business and tried to wing it, you'd probably be putting yourself in some trouble. So I think outlining.
Yeah.
And I find as well, like the more in-depth you go into the outline, the more of those happy accidents will occur in the outline. And then it's just a case of then you've got the skeleton and then kind of popping the clay onto it. So there's a couple of guys, a couple of characters. I say characters, obviously it's a memoir. So these are real life people. There's three of them that I'd really like to kind of ask you a little bit more about. Can you tell people about John from your it's John from the fruit picking days, right?
Yeah.
Right. Can you tell people a bit more about him? Because I was just like, who is this dude?
Well, first of all, let me just explain a little bit. Government Cheese is a memoir of mine. It's sort of covering what I call my sort of wilderness period, which lasted about 27 years. And it's kind of all of the shit that you go through as a writer. When people at the end, they say, wow, you're really good. Your stuff is great. You must have burst on the scene fully grown. And of course you didn't. You went to hell to get there. So this was, at one point I was doing migrant labor. picking fruit, picking apples, and in a kind of a bunkhouse operation where you, it was like an 8-week season that you tried to go through. And all of my fellow workers were what they call here fruit tramps, basically guys that like rode the rails, you know, rode the, got there on a boxcar. And there was one guy who was a former Marine who had been at the Chosin Reservoir. I know you know about that, Gez, but for your readers who don't, this was in the Korean War when a regiment of Marines were surrounded by the Chinese 9th Army at temperatures that went down to 40 below zero. And they fought their way back from this reservoir. It was so cold that when they loaded the bodies of their brother Marines onto trucks, to dead bodies, they would sometimes have to snap the arms and legs off them to get them into, you know, to get as many as they could in. So when I was talking to John, he sort of told me that he had been at the Chosin Reservoir. I just asked him, what was it like? Which was a really dumb question. And he just said, cold. And I said, when he said that, I knew that he had really been there and it was a real deal. And he was just, he was like kind of the prince of the pickers, of the fruit pickers. He could do it faster than everybody and do it, you know, he could last for hours and hours and hours. And he just, he became a kind of a mentor to me. I was maybe 20 years younger than him. And at the time, I'm probably giving you too long of a...
No, this is what I want, mate. Keep going.
One of the phrases that they used in the fruit picking deal was pulling the pin. And what pulling the pin meant was to quit before the job was over. Because it was a lousy job. You worked your ass off. It was no fun. And a lot of people would bail. And pulling the pin came from the railroad days where in order to uncouple one car from another, a trainman would pull a pin, a heavy metal pin out. So, and the way they paid you was they would give you three out of $4 each week that you'd earn, but they would hold $1 back and they would give you that as a bonus at the end of the season if you stayed all the way through the season. Because obviously they wanted the workers to stay there. They didn't want them to leave. So at the time, I was trying to finish my first book. I had saved money and et cetera, et cetera. And I was like 20 months into this thing. And finishing for me was like my demon. I couldn't do it. I would chicken out at the end. I would pull a pin, in other words. And many times in the fruit picking, I wanted to pull a pin. And my friend John, my mentor John, just would not let me. He kind of knew where I was coming from and he wouldn't let me pull the pin. And as a result of that, I did finish the book. And as a result of that, I never sold it, but I did finish it. I've never had any trouble finishing anything ever since. So I look back to John from Seattle. I never knew his last name.
That's amazing.
As one of the great mentors in my life that changed my life.
That's amazing. And this guy was married to a movie star. At one point.
Yeah, he wasn't married, but he had, you know, he had been with, you know, a hot young actress at some point in his life. Now he was basically, you know, a wino. He would just kind of, he lived in a single room occupancy hotel on Skid Row in Seattle, and he would come out for 3 months a year to do the fruit picking, and he could make enough money along with his disability check from the Marine Corps that he could live for the rest of the year. But basically, he was the walking wounded, and he knew it. Mm-hmm. But he was the kind of guy that could, for that maybe 3-month period, he could just simply stop drinking. He just had a really strong mind, despite the fact that he was a broken character.
So he'd drink the rest. So he'd work the summer, and then drink the rest of the year.
Drink to the point of passing out. That was how he went to sleep. You know.
Whoa. Did you ever get to see? You said that he had like a chest full of notes or something. About this stuff.
No, I never got to see that. I asked him once, you know, what was the experience like? And he said, I've got like, a trunk full of pages at home that I've written about it. But I guess he never really put it together.
Have you ever been tempted to write about that period, that battle?
Not particularly, but it certainly is a great thing to write about. I wish there had been something great written about it, or there's been really good documentaries about it, but I've never seen a movie or a book about it. Maybe there is, but it certainly was a, You know, the thing about the American Marine Corps is that Marines don't take so much pride in victories as they take in hellish experiences that they survived, you know, with incredibly high casualties and massive suffering. That's kind of what Marines really, point to, you know. So Chosin Reservoir was definitely one of those experiences.
I mean, one of your most well-known books is Gates of Fire. I mean, there's definitely some similarities between the two of them, right?
Yeah, definitely.
One of the other guys I was kind of interested in was the guy, was it John Trunnell?
On Trudell, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Trudell, sorry. So can you talk a bit more? Because obviously, the hippie movement and, you know, that kind of all these, this, that kind of like, I don't know if you want to call it an awakening or what was going on at the time there. I don't think it's something that really a lot of people, especially British people, younger people, have a grasp of what it was. So what was that movement like for you? What was your experience of it? What did you get out of it? What was the good bits? What was the bad bits?
Well, I was definitely caught up in that hippie movement, the counterculture movement, you know, and it's really hard to believe when I look at the world today. Nobody's ever written anything really great about that. I wish they had, because at that time, I really believed, and so many other young people believed, that the world had turned a corner and that we were never going to go back to the shit again. And then, of course, we went, not only did we go back to it, to this right-wing stuff that is now kind of taking over authoritarian governments all over the world, the restrictions of freedom, et cetera, et cetera. But it's gone back, even the pendulum has swung back way beyond where I thought it would. But I'll just tell you a little bit about John Trudell that's in the book. John Trudell died a few years ago, I think maybe in his 50s. And he was an American Indian, a poet, a songwriter, and an activist. And I just encountered him one time just as he was speaking at a park in L.A., just out under the tree. It was some kind of a hippie event. I don't know what it was. And I just sort of wandered over there, and there was maybe 50 people gathered around him. I didn't know who he was. I'd never heard of him. And he was talking, and he said, you see those two guys in the back of this, of the group here, the guys with the black shoes and the short haircuts and the neckties. He says, those are FBI guys. He said, they follow me everywhere I go. They think I'm a communist. They think I'm trying to overthrow the government. He says, let me tell you how I feel about that. He said to me, Russia and the United States are the same thing. There's no daylight between them. They both are cultures of extraction and exploitation, extracting of minerals and products from the earth and then selling them to pollute the planet, and exploitation of people whom they keep uneducated and dumb and exploit them by propaganda and so on and so forth. And he says, to them, the world is just a place of resources that they can exploit. He says, I come from completely the opposite school. To me, the earth is our mother, and we are here to protect her and not to see her ruined and polluted and exploited. So he said, this is John Trudell talking. He said, these guys, these FBI guys have me right. I am their enemy. I hate their guts, and I will fight them and everything they stand for. And I'll fight them and give my life if I have to. I'm not a communist. There's no difference between America and Russia in my mind. They're both the same paradigm of life. So I just thought at the time, that's my kind of guy. So I believe in that completely, what he said. And, I was really heartbroken when I heard that he died, you know, not that long after, but he was, he's a real hero of mine.
Yeah. I mean, it made a lot of sense to me, that passage, you know, but I just, it must have been, like I said, it's really hard for me to get, you know, to be able to put myself in a place where, you know, there must have been so much optimism for, like you said, in turning a corner, like, you know, it sounded like a little bit that you were saying in the book that, you know, you'd get these little kind of groups together that you'd live with and then they'd inevitably start breaking up and things like that. Is that kind of what happened to the movement at large? Did it collapse in on itself, or what kind of happened there? What was the demise?
I think it did. Yes, it was just sort of at a certain point. If you're 20 years old, or 21, or 23, or 24, you can kind of live that dream. You can get by within the greater society. You can be free in certain ways. But at some point, you get married, you start to have a couple of kids, and then you have to ask yourself, how am I going to support my kids? How am I going to send them to college? And at that point, you wind up getting a job, right? You wind up going straight, you know, just a simple thing like having long hair. At least back in those days, you'd have to cut your hair to get a job, right?
Right.
And so it no longer works that way, you know, but long hair doesn't mean the same thing as did today as it did then. And so I think one by one, people sort of, you know, went straight. They had to sort of get with the greater program. And little by little, the dreams kind of petered out. I mean, do you know that song? What is that? Jackson Brown song, After the Deluge. Do you know that song? Some of them were dreamers. Some of them were fools. And that's how he sort of describes that thing. And he said, and they had to, I forget what they said, but it was, they had to give up that dream and face the hard realities of life and making a living and taking care of your children. So I think that's kind of what happened.
You know, for you in that period, how did that kind of community fit in around you and your aspirations for what you wanted? Because it sounds like you've always had this drive to want to do this. Did it sap away from that, or did it give you a lot to work with? You know, what was its kind of relationship to your work?
Thanks for asking that question. It's a great question. It's a really insightful read of the book. I have actually never changed. I'm still there. I'm still, you know, living that dream in my mind. I mean, I'm fortunate enough as a writer, and you're in the same boat, that I can support myself doing what I want to do. I don't have to work for Mr. Charlie, you know? So I'm following my own muse. You know, I'm not necessarily politically spouting the same sort of counterculture stuff that I might have thought at that time, but I'm following my own star, you know, my own calling, whatever that is, in the books that I write. So I really, you know, I'll give myself a little credit. I have not sold out to the man yet. and I hope I won't ever.
Don't do it, mate. Part of the people. Okay, the last person I wanted to ask you about, and I'm probably going to get this name totally wrong as well, Dino De Laurinaitis?
Oh, Dino De Laurinaitis, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I knew I was going to butcher that one.
It's all right. I've spelled it Geraint. I didn't know it was a hard D.
This guy sounds like a real Hollywood character. Can you tell people a little bit about who he is and your kind of interactions with this person as a screenwriter in Hollywood?
Dino De Laurinaitis died, I think, in 2008 or something like that, and he was probably in his 70s at that point. But he was one of the post-war Italian film producers that kind of came out of, along with Roberto Rossellini and Fellini and Carlo Ponti and all those guys, and he was just this little guy. Actually, if there's a on Netflix now, there's an Arnold Schwarzenegger 3-part documentary, and he worked with Dino. Schwarzenegger did on Total Recall, the original Total Recall that I worked on as well. And he has a whole section about Dino De Laurinaitis. But he was he married Miss Rome in the immediate post-war open city era, right, you know, after World War II, and began producing, I think he produced something like 500 movies. Most of them were absolute shit. They were just total exploitation, tits and ass movies, that kind of thing. But he also made a bunch of really good movies, Italian movies, and I think he made Serpico. He made 3 Days of the Condor. I think he made Serpico. I might be wrong on that. And he was just a really colorful Hollywood producer that they don't make them anymore. You know, Italian Hollywood producer. He would, like you, he couldn't read English. He spoke English, but he didn't want to read it. So if you were to submit a screenplay to him, he had to have it translated into Italian first, and then he would read it. He would read it that way. And I sort of got involved with him because my writing partner at the time was working on Total Recall. That was his project. And it was sort of in production for years with Dino. And so Dino would throw us, meanwhile, sort of scraps. You know, he would throw us a little project. Here, write this one for me. Here, write this one for me, to kind of keep us alive while that movie was in the works. So anyway, a very colorful Hollywood dude, a real guy, Dino De Laurentiis.
Yeah, there's some really interesting characters that you come across in there. But to keep it with LA, I think this really kind of ties into something you've covered a lot on your social media. You know, you've got the book about it. Kind of like put your ass where your heart wants to be. Can you talk us through a bit more, like what you mean by that, and you know, how that worked in your own life?
That's another good question, guys. Thank you. Put your ass where your heart wants to be is kind of a mantra of mine, and it can be interpreted in many ways, on many levels. But one level is, and I know that you kind of lived this way too, Gez, is move your ass to the city or the place where your dream can come true. And a kind of a, if you want to be a ballet dancer, you've got to be in New York or Paris or Rome or one of those places where you can be seen, where there are classes, where you can become part of a community. And if you want to be in the movie business, you know, Hollywood movie business, pretty much you have to be in LA. You have to be there where somebody can get on the phone and say, Gez, can you get in here tomorrow morning at 6:30? You know, we got a problem. And you can say, I'll be there. And the reason I say this is that put your ass where your heart wants to be is really important, is because when you're actually there in the place, those people that you interact with, your peers, other writers, let's say, or other actors, other producers, so on, they take you seriously because you're there. You've actually left England or wherever it is that you want to be, Wales or wherever, and you put your ass on the line here. And so immediately you're sort of a member of the community. And it's not just your peers, but the mentors, people who will hire you, people who will take you under their wing, people that that you can work for and learn from, older partners. Like I had an older partner for about 5 years and, you know, learned a tremendous amount from him. But that doesn't happen unless your ass is there in that spot. So I'm a big believer in that. Now, of course, it's not always true for, let's say, novelists. Like somebody like Stephen King lives in Maine, and then I think he lives in Sarasota, Florida in the winter. He doesn't have to be any particular place because he sort of carries his own personal hotspot wherever he goes, right? He's Stephen King, right? He doesn't need to be anywhere. But certainly in the movie business, where it's a more collaborative thing, if you're a writer, you got to be there because you've got to pitch your material to people. You know, you really can't do it remotely. They want to see you there. So that's one interpretation of put your ass where your heart wants to be. It goes a lot deeper than that, too.
Yeah, and I would say as well, even with the writing, the novel thing, you know, speaking from like my personal experience, I'm sure you're the same way. Whenever there's a meeting, it's not in Wrexham, or you know, it's you're getting that train. I mean, like last week, you know, it's take a train down for an hour long meeting and come home. So it's like, if you want to do it, your ass, even if your ass isn't going to be there full time, it's going to have to go to get anything actually moving.
Yeah.
So with the book, you mentioned mentors. Do you think maybe like in this kind of day and age, because we've got social media stuff and people can kind of see, you know, if you want to become, if you want to be in the NFL now, might be a bit of a bad example, but, you know, you have access to a lot of people online. So, you know, a lot of people have podcasts, a lot of people have YouTube channels, Instagram accounts, you name it. And, you know, some people are quite, you know, yourself included, very active on there. which is in a way a great thing. I mean, that's how you and me connected. you know, I consider you a mentor. So it's been great like that. But do you think that maybe that has made a lot of people kind of disinclined to follow that principle of put your ass where your heart wants to be?
That's a really good question. Maybe it has, because it's sort of a safe way, an online way, right? You don't actually have to be there with the person. But, you know, I just mentioned this Arnold Schwarzenegger documentary on Netflix. It's really interesting on the subject of mentors. Like when he first came to LA from Austria to try to make it, you know, as a bodybuilder, he established relationships with Joe Gold of Gold's Gym, the original guy who let him train there for free, and with Joe Weider, the guy who did the muscle and fitness magazines and who ran a lot of the, and his hero, Reg Park, who was the original Hercules in movies. Arnold, you know, met him and competed against him, and Reg Park sort of took him under his wing, took him to South Africa where he lived, and Arnold lived with Reg Park's family for a while. And there's nothing like that face-to-face, person-to-person thing where you really become part of the family of somebody, because then a mentor like that can move you, can introduce you, open doors to the next person, which can never really happen online, I don't think, or remotely. There's nothing quite like face-to-face contact. You know, I was watching the series The Last Dance. Do you know that one, Gez, about Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls?
Yes, so great. Yeah,
which was great, right? And there was an interview or a little clip there where Kobe Bryant was talking. And he was talking about when he was 19 and he was in his first All-Star game. And Michael Jordan was a really established superstar at that point. He was maybe, I don't know what, 10 years older than Kobe or something like that. And Kobe guarded him for part of the time in the All-Star game. And Kobe was saying, there's nothing like being next to the guy, feeling his strength, feeling how fast he is, feeling how strong, feeling the moves that he's got. And of course, Michael Jordan became a great mentor to him, you know? But there is nothing like that face-to-face friendship that can happen, both because the mentor can kind of see you and look at you, Gez, and say, ah, this guy's the real deal. Let me see if I can help him. You know, you can tell it in person when you can't necessarily tell it online.
I think, you know, you mentioned Gold's Gym there, and obviously for Arnold, that's the place to be, right? But I think as well, this principle, and I totally, you know, I totally agree with you on it, is it's not just being in there from the point of view of that's where it's everyone that's in there in that industry, they go to the gyms, they go to the bars and everything like that. And, you know, like you could be working out in the gym somewhere like that and be next to somebody who used to run a studio.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or some, and maybe that mentorship might only be a 5-minute conversation, but like, you know, because there's different levels of mentorship. It might be 5 minutes of knowledge from somebody. And just like that, just in that, you pick up one little piece that's just going to move you a little bit further down the road towards where you want. And, you know, I think maybe like, I'm a massive believer in, I think, you know, you go to the gym, you see people's souls laid bare, don't you? It's a great,
yeah.
You've already got that band of brothers thing just by the fact that, hey, we're both here to work, we're both here to sweat, we're both here to go through a little pain. And I think straight away when you meet someone in a gym, you know that there's a kind of, you know, like you say, you kind of get a bit of a measure of the person by, you know, the fact that they're kind of in there. So note to anybody that wants to meet people, go to the gym.
But it's true, though. When you're in the gym, right, and you always come at the same time, right? People come at the same time. You're like a 5 a.m. or 6 a.m. people. And then there's a whole crew that always also comes at the same time. And because you're walking past them all day, you know, after a little while, you may not even have spoken to somebody, but you say, hi, how you doing, da-da-da-da. And then, you know, 3 months down the road, you go to breakfast with them, and the next thing you know, you have a little friendship going. Like you say, anything can come out of that. Anything good can come. It's a great thing. But if you're not there, it can't happen. You have to be there.
Right. Exactly. One of the things I found interesting about this is kind of getting a look into some of your relationships that you've had, you know, some, and some, obviously, you know, now I met Diana or know Diana, but it's, you know, like anybody in their life, there's rocky relationships and there's good relationships. And I was thinking, we've got a lot of young listeners on the podcast here. What are some of the things that, with the benefit of hindsight, you learned about your early relationships that you could, like, you could have that mentoring moment now and tell young lads who probably won't listen, let's just be honest, but if what you could tell them about what to do and what to avoid when they're in those relationships in like the early stages of their adult life?
Well, I'm pretty much an idiot at this thing. Yes, I don't know if I would, you know, I have to recuse myself because I'm certainly, you know, have a long string of bad shit happening, you know. So yeah, I really don't know anything really positive to say. Just that
you can plead the fifth on this one.
Sometimes pain and suffering is good for you as a writer. Let me put it that way.
Mate, that's one of the weird things about being a writer. The worst day in your life could be happening. You're thinking, oh, this is going to make some good material.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
All right. Well, let me tell what I kind of picked up from it then, if you don't mind.
Okay, please do. Maybe I'll learn something from you.
Well, just looking from the outside, I kind of felt like you realized that, like, you had this thing inside of you that if you didn't get it out of you, it was going to kill you. And also poison everything around you and drag other people down. And that's kind of what I took from it, was that it was like, there's nothing personal in there about it. It's not like, oh, I don't like this woman, I don't find this person attractive or anymore. It wasn't that. It's just like, I have to do this. I have to pursue this career, and I can't do it in this small town in the South, or, you know, I have to be in this place. I have to do this as a job, and I might fail, but you know, it's almost that thing of, right, you'd rather die than not have it happen. And that's kind of what I took away from it. And you know, I think we've all been in relationships where we've been on the wrong, you know, we've been on the end of a dumping, and we take it personally. And like, I think a lot of the times it's never even about us. It's nothing about us. It's about something that other person has, a journey they have to go on. You know, something in their life that they were born to achieve. You know, I think you and me are kind of believers in that we have this thing within us that, for wherever it comes from, that you have to pursue. And that's kind of what I took away from, you know, from that. And it's not a bad thing to go after that, because if not, you're probably going to end up just being a shit husband, shit dad. You know, you're going to be miserable. And like, when you, like, mood is contagious. When you're happy and living a fulfilled life, that spreads. I mean, what, you know, right now, you and me, buzzing, having this conversation, it spreads that, you know, that you're doing something and you're leading by example in that. But by the same way, you can lead by example with misery, you know, and just make everyone else miserable. So that's kind of what I took away from it.
Well, that's pretty good, Gez. I like that. I think you hit the nail on the head. Yeah. Certainly for me, there were many moments when I sort of could have, like, tried to really make a relationship work or something like that. But if I had, or any other kind of situation, a work situation, right, or something like that. But if I had, and I had to give up on this crazy dream, whatever it was that I had, I would have been miserable, and I would have made the other person miserable. So I was one of those people that had to, like you say, had to keep following that one particular star, you know, and just keep doing it. Because, like you say, I'd rather die than not give it my all.
Mm-hmm. And that's a great point that you just made there as well, is the fact that it's not just relationships, it's anything. It's where you're living. It's where you're living, it's where you're working, it's anything like that. You know, it's not that you can't do it, but it's just, you know, it's... And, you know, I think it's difficult, because when you're trying to explain that to somebody, and again, I'm sure there's a lot of people listening, nodding along now, who is having these conversations with people that they care about in their lives, and those people care about them. But when someone doesn't get it, you know, it's like trying to say to someone that the sky is purple or whatever, you know, they're seeing blue and you're seeing purple. It's, if someone hasn't felt that, it's incredibly difficult to do it. But this brings us back to the principle of, put your ass where your heart wants to be. Because when you do, you'll be surrounded by people who think exactly the same way as you, and they'll get it. And all of a sudden, you won't feel like you're crazy, and you won't feel like you're an outsider, or that you think, you know, because I'm sure you had the same. You probably had these feelings of, who the fuck do I think I am?
Uh-huh.
Do I think I'm better than all these other people and stuff? And then you realize that it's not that at all. You just have something different. And some people can be happy in one place, and some people have to be happy in another. And I think that's something that a lot of, like, not just artists, but anyone that wants to do something that's slightly different to the norm around them, you know, you get this feeling of like, oh shit, like, what is this driving me? Is this ego? Is this, you know, am I running away from something? But you're not running away, you're running to. And I think there's a big difference between those two kind of things.
Yeah. I mean, I myself always felt terrible in those moments, you know, and I always blamed myself. It wasn't like I ever felt like, oh, I'm better than this situation, and I have, you know, really, I felt like, what's wrong with me? Am I crazy? Why do I have this calling, this need to keep trying whatever it is? I must be out of my mind, you know? It's not working for me. Like, for me, it took me 27 years before I published, you know, got my first book published. So for all that time, I'm thinking to myself, what's wrong with me? Am I out of my mind? And my family thought of me that same way. You know, it was like, poor Steve, the poor guy, you know, can he pull himself out of this? You know, what's wrong with him? Why won't he let go of this thing? You know? But you know, you just don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell people how long it took you until you realized that you were going to be okay? You were going to make it. It was going to work out.
I would say until my first book got published, which I was 52 years old. That was The Legend of Bagger Vance. But this is kind of an interesting thing, I think. A lot of times in movies or in the stories that you see, there's like one breakthrough and then the hero is golden, mm-hmm. right? But in my experience, it's multiple breakthroughs. And almost immediately after you have the breakthrough, there's a total letdown. Like, you think, oh, I've really turned a corner here. You know, this is great. Everything's going to be, and then nothing happens, you know, and you're sort of are back in the mud again, and you have to kind of keep grinding and keep grinding. Then you have another breakthrough and you think, oh, this is it. I've turned the corner. It's going to be, you know, and then you're back in the mud again after that. So that it's sort of a series of breakthroughs that kind of, you just have to believe in them, you know, and little by little, progress is made. But I think finally, when my first book was published, I did sort of say to myself, you know, this is inflated as it may sound, Gez, but I felt like, oh, my life has been worth it up to this, even though it wasn't, you know, people forget, you know, book makes a tiny, tiny splash and people forget it 2 seconds later. But for me, I felt like a mountain I've always wanted to climb, I finally have climbed this motherfucker, you know?
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. You've mentioned before that you like to go to the gym in the morning because it's the hardest thing you're going to do that day, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of working on that, building that mental toughness and things. What point was it that you started? Because, I mean, it sounds like, you know, you were living on the road, you were living out your van, you know, just to give people an idea, you know, is it your first day fruit picking, you came across somebody who just dropped dead?
Yeah.
In the field. So, I mean, we're talking about some fucking backbreaking shit. So obviously that in itself, and the Marines before that. But when was it exactly that you started to kind of actively go after fitness? So, like, not kind of job related fitness, but I'm going to start. You know, where did you pick that up from? Was that from a mentor that kind of got you into that?
I think I just partly, it was no specific mentor, but it just was clear to me kind of instinctively that I was the kind of person that had to start the day early and had to do it in a kind of a throw yourself against the wall type of way, you know? I know there are writers that like write late at night and they're drunk or they're, you know, they do things. I'm not from that school. I have to really organize my day and almost, you know, hour by hour and sort of stick to that, because, you know, in my book, The War of Art, I talk about the concept of resistance with a capital R, meaning the self-sabotage that we all do to ourselves, you know, procrastination, self-doubt, all that sort of stuff. That, to me, is an ongoing enemy that hits me the minute I wake up. So my whole day is sort of built around, the rhythm of my whole day is built on combating that, taking whatever steps I need to kind of keep my positive momentum going and not allow any of that self-sabotage to get a toehold at all. So that's sort of, I can't say that I even could have articulated that when I first started being an early morning person, but I sort of knew it instinctively.
Have you ever tried the drinking writing? Did you ever go, right, I'm going to try? Because, I mean, we've all heard about, you know, your Hemingways, and apparently I think Stephen King was well known for it, wasn't he, just being off his face?
I don't even really know about that, but I know from reading Hemingway, and when he talks about his process, he was a really disciplined, hardworking guy. He might have started drinking late in the day, but I don't think he was the kind of a writer that like got drunk and wrote. I think he was the opposite. He was very much a guy that, you know, worked every day and took it really, really seriously. And I don't know about his drinking thing, but I don't think he did that as a way to write. And I don't understand. I guess it works for somebody. It sure didn't work for me, or couldn't work for me. I'm not a drinker at all.
Did you try it out?
No, I'm not. I'm just not a drinker at all. I really don't even like the taste of it.
Yeah, because I mean, I must admit, I was like, you know, you're trying to find like, all right, well, what's the best way of doing this? And you try right in the morning, you try right in the evening, try writing drunk, try writing sober. And I'm a big believer that writing sober, and I don't just mean sober on the day, I mean for an extended period of time, I think you just get a clarity of thought, you know. But then it's an interesting one, because we look at some of the best musicians and stuff of our time, and they were constantly fucked up.
Let me ask you something, Gez, as far as your writing techniques.
Go on.
I mean, we all as writers are hoping to get to that moment when we're in the flow, right? When our ego goes away, and that might seem in contrast to being sober. How do you work those two ends of the street?
It's again, like you said, mate, it's routine, really. I think trying to have a good routine, approaching it as a job. Having clearly defined targets. Again, this is where I think the outline helps. Can look at that outline, break it down into sections. So we've had this guy, Dean Stott, who I'll have to introduce you to sometime because you guys don't live too far from each other. You know, he cycled the Pan American Highway in 99 days. And he said if he'd have looked at what he had to do entirely, he never would have got on the fucking plane. But by breaking it down into days, into hours, it was, I'm going to do this hour. Now I'm going to do this hour. And I think, you know, a lot of people want to write books or want to start businesses or want to lose 100 pounds, whatever it is. But you look at a book, 100 pounds, business, and you're like, fuck, like like you said, it's a mountain. But if you go, well, if I just walk up to that next rock, and then I walk up to that next rock. And if you break it down like that, it's not overwhelming anymore. It's an hour's work. You know, it's one workout at a time, you know, which could be 20 minutes when you get started. It's 20 minutes a day. That's kind of how I approach it. I try and avoid, I did an experiment. I wrote a script, and it's quite a bonkers script. And I put away a lot of alcohol while I was writing it, and but I outlined it sober, and then I wrote it drunk, and then I edited it sober, and then I left it a few weeks until I'd been sober a few weeks, and then I edited it again. But whenever I'm doing a book, especially if I'm ghostwriting for someone else, like if someone's paying for my time, then they deserve my time and not my hungover time. So that's just, it's just the same as anything else. Like if I came into the studio tonight and Peter was snorting lines of coke, I'd probably be like, what are you doing, Peter? Well, you know, we're working. I find personally for me, a disciplined approach works, treating it like a job and treating it like a privilege, you know, because we are privileged. to do what we do.
We are.
You know, we've both worked hard for it.
We pay for the privilege, but we are privileged.
Right, exactly. So that's kind of it, mate. On that subject then, right, this is one of the things I loved, kind of, and again, this is something, because, and you know, I mentioned this in the introduction, but I just want to mention, say this again, you know, this is specifically, you know, for you as a writer, obviously I'm a writer too, but these principles all just apply to anything, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you were wanting to climb Mount Everest, just what you were talking about, Gez, about breaking something down into component parts, you know, and it's the principle I was talking about before, the movie writing principle of starting at the end, you know, having your first scene and knowing what your climax is going to be. Like if you and I were going to climb Mount Everest, you know, we could start at the end. We're at the summit, you know, or even the end beyond that when we've come down from the summit. But let's just say we start at the summit and then we start thinking backwards. Well, if I want to get there, what do I have to do to get there? Right. Well, we know we're going to have to get to India or Nepal. Mm-hmm. Right. Step one, we're going to have to find Sherpas. We're going to have to do all that kind of thing. We're also going to have to be in incredible shape, oxygen wise and so on and so forth. And we're also going to have to be really skilled mountaineers. And then beyond that, we're going to have money. We're going to have to focus, because this is going to take however long it's going to take, right? So now we will take those steps back and say, okay, what do I have to do to get to that place? And we can write out an entire document that goes from the summit of Everest backwards to where we are right now. And then we've got our first step. Let's say our first step is we got to get together $80,000. We got to have that between now and X date. And then, okay, how are we going to do that? But yeah. It applies to anything, a business, a relationship, anything.
Yeah. And I mean, as with all your books, it's you know, it's just even if somebody has no goals or dreams or anything like that, it's just a really nice book to read. And one of the things I love about your writing as well is that sometimes, you know, you'll have a long chapter and sometimes your chapter will be a paragraph long. And I love that because I hate, you know, there's so many books out there that are that the public, you can tell, was a great idea and would have made a great 30,000 word book that the publisher's gone, no, it needs to be 80,000. And then it's just filled out with, you know, they've just put all this, you know, like a lot of these nonfiction kind of, I don't want to say self-help books, but personal development books. You know, quite often there's a nugget of information in there and a great idea and a great concept that the publisher's clearly gone, it's got to be 80,000 words. And it's just all crap around there. And I love it because I think kind of reminds me of, you know, Michael Hurd, Dispatches. I think one of the, you know, some of the most powerful parts in that book were just like this two or three lines and that would just be it. But you can tell a story in a paragraph and you do that in this book, you know, and that's like, and they're quite often the more hard hitting ones, right? Those kind of like those short ones. So I think within the book as well, just the way that it's written is a lesson, which is, don't fucking listen to what you want to write. Listen to what your kind of your heart is or the muse or wherever these ideas are coming from. And don't go, right, this is a great chat. Like now I have to spin this paragraph out into the same length chapter as all the other ones. Fuck that. Like, so I love that, mate. I love it.
Yeah, we've talked about that before, Gez. You and me, you know, like it's got to be the 80,000 words the publisher insists upon. Like when I start reading one of those books, I put it down after page, you know, 18. It's like, okay, I got it. I got the message of the book, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want to see another, you know, 500 pages of padding, you know, or 250 pages of padding. Besides, when I'm reading a book, I love to come to a short chapter. You know, I love to come to something that's like a half a page. It's like, oh, great. I don't have to wade through all this other stuff. I can get the meat of something. And the writer has taken the time to boil it down and get rid of the extraneous crap, you know? Yeah, so I like it when I read a book like that.
I was going to say that can be the harder part too, though, right? Like getting a story across in a paragraph, you know?
Yeah.
But obviously...
But when you can do it, it works great.
Yeah, well, you did, mate. It's really good. I love those. I also, like, we don't need to kind of go into this one, but I just want, and I have to say, like, I love the story about Mo the Cat, you know, the way you came across him and stuff. And obviously, you know, I'm a big cat guy, you know, myself and... I guess it's like having that silent partner almost that you can just talk to and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Through a lot of my travels, I had a cat that I found as a little kitten along the side of the road when he was so small, he could just fit in a palm of one hand. And he was like a little amused to me. You know, I felt like the great thing about a cat as opposed to a dog, not that I'm knocking dogs, but a cat is self-contained. You know, it particularly, my cat was always an outdoor cat. You know, he would hunt for birds and stuff like that. Not that I didn't feed him, I did, but, you know, and you as a writer or an artist, you want to be self-contained too. You want to, you know, my cat, I often thought that he was, like I say in Government Cheese, he was living the cat life and I was living the writer's life. And they're really parallels. The same, he had his own world and he totally lived in it. You know, he lived in the moment. And he was a role model for me, you know?
Yeah.
Us cat people, we understand that.
No, mate, I totally agree. I love that story. The last thing I wanted to talk about, again, this is such an applicable point, I think, to everyone, no matter what your kind of aspirations are, is having a slate. So can you tell us what a slate is and where you learned this lesson and the importance of it?
That's great that you picked that out, Guess. When I was working as a screenwriter in Hollywood, I had a friend, a woman who was a producer. And one day she asked me, we were talking, and she said, you know, what's your next project? And I didn't know, you know, I sort of stammered, you know, and she said, you can't do that. You got to know. She said, and she was saying that like every studio has a slate, meaning they've got 40 pictures in production or in development meaning it being written, even though they're not going for the camera yet. You know, they've got a comedy, they've got a, you know, a ghost story, they've got slasher movies, they've got Marvel comic, they've got a whole slate of, and she said, you as a writer, you have to have a slate too. You can't just have one thing you're working on. You got to have, if I say to you, what else are you working on? You got to have five things at least that you can rattle off to me right away as a pitch, you know, because you and I, this is the producer talking to me, we're in business, just like 20th Century Fox is in business. And we have to be just as professional as they are. Steven Spielberg's got a slate. Ben Affleck's got a slate. Matt Damon's got to pick anybody. They've got 20, 30 projects that are kind of on various burners, front burners, back burners, so on and so forth. So I do think that that's always something you have to think about. It's a thinking of yourself, not so much as only an artist, but as an artist and a professional, that you're not fucking around here. You know, you've got, when someone says, you know, step up to the plate, you're ready to do it.
Mm. And again, I think this is something you can expand, you know, into, to kind of like, you know, wider life and stuff as well. That's like, you know, so if you've got, because one of the things, as much as you said, as a writer with self-contained, there comes a point where you have to hand that baton off, and then it becomes the agents, the publishers, the you know, like, well, and well, you've kind of talked about this before, so we won't go into it in depth, but, you know, you have to be your own publicist these days and stuff, you know. But to some degree, you're handing something off, you know, you can still then do work on it. But, and a lot of times you'll get derailed, and this could be in business or something, you know, you might have a business idea that you're working on that, let's just say you've had a great idea for business. And then all of a sudden where you were planning to open the business, someone else opens one up there. And that can be soul destroying. That can be totally demoralizing. And if you haven't got something else on the quote unquote slate, you know, that you can go, oh, well, you know what? Shit. Put some work into that. It's not going to happen. Fair, right. Now, it doesn't matter. I've already got this other thing that's kind of in a different, like things at different stages that you can get, you know, that you can get into. And I think, you know, it could be that you break your arm and you can't go to the gym, but you've got something else going in your life. So I think having a slate of things going on in our lives is a really good way of kind of putting it. So there's so many gems in this book, mate. I'm really, really glad that you wrote it. So thank you, Diana, for pushing you into that one.
I'll tell her.
But it's a really great book, mate. It was really enjoyable read. Is there anything else about it that you'd like to tell people before we wrap things up?
Just that the person that I was writing this book for. You know, at some point when you are in the throes of self-doubt as you're writing something, you say, why am I doing this? Is this, you know, you have to ask yourself, who is this for? What do I want? And what do I want to give to the person that this is for? And I thought, this is for anybody that is particularly a younger person that's struggling to find their calling or has found it and is in the throes of, you know, the struggles that you go through. And you feel like I'm never going to see daylight at the end of this tunnel. I've been going so long with no success, no feedback, et cetera, et cetera. It's for that person because the tunnel that I was in was so long, 27 years, you know, without any success at all, really, that I think my story, I hope will be encouraging to people. And they'd say, and also I think not that my story was exceptional. I think it's a long road to do anything, you know? And a lot of times I think young people today think success can be instant. You know, you do a sex tape and put it on Instagram and it goes viral. And the next thing you know, you're Kim Kardashian, right? But life doesn't work like that. You know, it's a long, long struggle to learn the shit that you have to learn. And so that's what I'm sort of hoping to give to somebody that reads this book, to say, well, if this guy can make it through there, I can make it through too.
I'm going to have to ask one more question off the back of that. How do you kind of define success?
These days, I think of writing. Well, let me put it a different way. You said this before in a different way, Gaz. I think we live on two levels. We live on the material level of survival and physical reality, but there's a higher level and there's a kind of an underground river flowing through us. And that river is our calling and our creativity. If you're a writer, it's kind of a series of books. If you're a filmmaker, it's a series of films. If you're a musician, a dancer, whatever it is. And that river, we have to serve that river. If we don't serve that river, we're going to get cancer and everything else, right? So that river doesn't go away. So for me, in order to serve that river, we have to learn, number one, the skill, the physical skills and the emotional skills. What does it take to write a book? What does it take to write a movie? A lot of skills, you know, how do you handle rejection? All that sort of stuff. And we also have to serve that river, serve our muse. So that's how I define success. If I can keep serving and keep, you know, asking the goddess, what's the next thing you want me to do? And if I can pay my rent between now and the next project, that's success to me. And I think you can drive yourself crazy if you're judging it by the mainstream commercial standards of success.
Right.
You know, it's really, to me, can I keep working? Can I keep working? Mm-hmm. That's success to me. It's a practice to me, a practice like yoga or martial arts that I do every day. And that keeps me sane and keeps me happy.
I think that's a great way of putting it, mate. Finally, then, where's the best place for people to get the book?
I guess it's on Amazon in the UK. It's called Government Cheese. I'm sure you'll tell people that.
Do you still have any signed copies going or anything like that people could?
We don't officially, but if anybody wanted to order a signed hardcover, just reach out to me on Instagram. I'm on Instagram and we'll make something happen that way. We did a thing where we signed about 1,500 copies and they came in a special VIP pack. And we still have a few of those. But otherwise, you really can't get the book. You can get it in bookstores if you order it, but it won't be in bookstores because we published it independently, Diana and I. So it's not published by Houghton Mifflin or Simon & Schuster or anything like that. We can't get it in bookstores. So it's online. It's on Amazon.
I mean, that's a whole other conversation we'll have to have sometime because I think that's a fascinating one.
Yeah.
But I will link up the Amazon link and I'll also put Steve's Instagram in the show notes. So if you guys just want to go down and click on there.
Great. Thanks, Gaz. Hey, thanks for having me, and thanks for reading the book so carefully, and thanks for the great question. It's always great to talk to you, and you know, great to share. You know, writer to writer, and fellow soldier in the trenches. You know, that's just what we are.
Well, mate, I appreciate your time. I'm looking forward to seeing you guys in a few months' time. But mate, thanks so much, and like I said, thank you for writing the book. I just want to say before I go, it's one of those books. I feel like The War of Art was the same, and some of the other books that you've done, where, you know, it's great to read it from cover to cover, but it's also one of those ones that you can just open up on any chapter and just enjoy that chapter and just, you know, take it away. There's like, I recommend people read it start to finish, but then keep it by your bed. And then every time you're having one of those little dips, which we all have, just pick it up, read a chapter or two, get back to fucking work. So, mate, thanks so much for writing it, mate. And thanks for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Hey, great. Thanks, Gez. Great to see you. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for the great questions.
Cheers, Steve.
Till I see you here in LA. I'll see you soon.
See you soon, mate. Have a good one.
Thanks, mate. Bye.